Well, good morning, everybody. I've got my handy audio recorder on. Did you find the recordings on the website useful? Listen to them over and over again in the car, so you've got everything memorized now. Well, they're there. And they're there partly so that we don't have to go over things that that you've missed in class. You can listen to the recordings if you want. And then partly, every once in a while, someone gets sick or they get married and they can't come to the class. And that's missing a sixth of the course. So to make it up, you have to listen to the recording and then do an assignment to cover what you've missed. So some of you got my email last night. Please send me an electronic copy of your paper. And what I like to do is to sit down at the computer and use Microsoft Word, track changes to make comments, and then send them back to you. And I usually don't send them back until I've made comments in all the papers, because it would be unfair. But I'll start tomorrow to do some of the grading. And what I find is that I can't sit in front of the computer for more than an hour or two marking the papers. So that's why it's wonderful to have a hard copy. And I stand up and I walk around the house, exercise my legs, read the hard copy, and then I go back to the electronic copy and send comments. But please use Microsoft Word, because for the PDF files I can't make comments on them. So I just have to write something on these, and you probably can't read my writing. I could have gone to medical school. My writing is so bad. Anyway, that's for the assignments. Thank you very much. And I'll have them by November 17th, but if I have them all sooner, I'll send you individual comments, because I know you'll need them for the next assignment. Any questions with regard to the assignments for today? So this is the sign-up sheet for attendance. So please sign your name and make sure you've got the I've got the email for you correct. Is Tracy Taylor here? Tracy, for some reason I got a message saying that my email to you had been delayed. The one that I sent last night. So just make sure this is the right email.
Okay.
On the course outline that you had, it said that chapter 13 was going to be covered both today and in the November class. That was an error. So I corrected that now. I'm going to be covering the first part of chapter 14 on Aboriginal rights at the end of the class today. And then the person signed up for the reading for chapter 13 next month, plus the second part of chapter 14. That's still correct. So we'll do the presentations in the order on the sign-up sheet. For each of the presentations, occasionally someone who's supposed to present doesn't show up, so I'm prepared to do all the presentations. So what I will do is, after your presentation, I want you to keep it to about 4 minutes, so we can have a discussion, and then I can cover some of the points that you might not have hit in your presentation. Now, there's quite a bit of reading in this program, and what I suggested to you is you spread it out over the month, not wait until the last minute. Did that work? Pretty much? Yeah, if you kind of set aside half an hour a day to do some of the readings, you'll learn a lot more, and it'll be, you won't be panicking at the last minute. Any questions from last month's class, from the September class? So some of the slides I went over very quickly or didn't get to at all last month. Any questions about those points that might have been a bit mysterious? Not, you can raise them later. Oh, and good news about the French for Public Administration for any of you that have signed up. It will be offered. The professor, Diane Woody, who was going to teach it, has become an associate dean in Liberal Arts and Professional Studies. She's fabulous. She's the Associate Dean Teaching and Learning. So we have to find somebody else to teach it, and it will be rescheduled at a time when you can take it. So hang in there. And if you haven't signed up for French Public Administration and want to, you still have a chance to do that. And there will be a subsidy from the School of Public Policy Administration to cover part or all of your tuition, which is about $900. So, Chapter 7 in Monaghan. So Patrick Monaghan has been, I've been at York University 28 years, I think he's been here, if he'd been here the whole time, 29 years. I think he came the year before I came. And he also had Peter Russell as his inspirational professor at the University of Toronto. He took a few years off in the late 1980s to be, first of all, the special advisor to Ian Scott, the Attorney General, and then to David Peterson, who is the Premier. And so much of what he writes in the text is informed by that experience of, I think, 3 or 4 years working at higher levels in the Ontario government. He was also involved in constitutional negotiations. So I remember talking to Patrick before he worked for government, and then after, and he learned a lot from the experience, just like I did. Finished my master's degree and then worked for the Alberta government for several years, and my views about how government worked changed a lot. I remember talking to Michael Ignatieff shortly after he was elected, not as the Liberal leader, but as a member of Parliament. And he said, you know, I've been teaching political science for 25 years, just about everything I've been teaching is wrong. Anyway, Patrick you can trust because he has had that experience, and so what he's writing about is the truth now. So in Chapter 7, one of the points that he made is the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council had difficulty interpreting the division of powers. Because government has changed a lot since 1867. In 1867, the idea was that the role of government is very limited. In 1867, of course, Canadians were mostly concerned about defending themselves against the United States. And part of that was developing a strong economy and so on, and cooperation between the new provinces. Of course, this is the 200th anniversary of the War of 1812. And so that was Canada's War of Independence. We were, thanks to the help of the Aboriginal peoples of Canada, we defended ourselves successfully against the United States and were not absorbed. The U.S. Congress was determined to take over Canada. They didn't succeed. Anyway, in 1867, Canadians were still terrified of being taken over by the United States. The government was there for defense, to keep order, but the role of government was very limited. So that's one reason the JCPC started off in many ways on the wrong foot interpreting the division of powers, and then they were stuck because of stare decisis, the doctrine of precedent, although they found creative ways of getting around it, as will be seen in this class. Monaghan says that some of the tests developed by the JCPC that we'll be talking about today to interpret the division of powers were what he calls bright line tests. That is very, very distinct, no ambiguity, this is how we're going to do it. And that didn't necessarily work for interpreting a constitution. And also, as we'll be seeing in some of the cases today, that one of the doctrines of interpretation we talked about last month was the idea that the judges give precedence to specific concepts over general concepts. The list of powers in Section 92, the provincial list, is generally more specific than the general terms in Section 91. And so there was a tendency to interpret those specific terms more broadly. That might sound like a contradiction, but because the terms were specific, well, let's go to those, we know what they mean, and gradually the provincial powers got expanded. What I'd like you to do, by the way, is to you turn to page 553, if you have the Russell text with you, and just put a bookmark in it or something, and that's an abbreviated Section 91 and Section 92, the important parts of the division of powers and the judiciary provisions and so on. So, as we get into the cases, we'll be referring to specific sections of Section 91 and 92. And what lawyers tend to do is they don't tell you what's in the section, they just say 92.13. You're expected to know what it means. So if these sections come out in our discussions and you're confused as to what we're referring to, then you can quickly refer to that, and it'll soon sink in here and you'll never forget it. You'll be able to impress your families at dinner. And Monahan says that in the last 50 or 60 years, governments have started to legislate in areas that were never thought of in 1867, such as laws related to the environment. Welcome. The result of this new legislation, since it doesn't seem to be covered by very clearly by Section 91 or Section 92, what Pat Monahan learned when he was working for the Ontario government, if you're not sure whether the government can do it, you just do it. And somebody might take you to court and then you might have to defend what you've done, but usually it takes years for a case to get to court. So by the time the case gets to court, you've done what you want to do anyway. But what it's meant is that both the federal and the provincial governments are legislating in areas never contemplated in 1867. And so what often happens is that both governments legislate in the same area. And one of those areas is the environment. So the courts have held that in many ways, both the federal government and the provinces can legislate with regard to the environment. And the conflict of laws approach means that if both laws are valid, then you have to obey both as long as you can obey the strictest of the two without contradicting yourself. So in many cases, the courts have said that both federal and provincial environmental laws are valid, but in a few cases, they've struck down one or the other because they're related to other areas of Section 91 or 92. So he says that key issue in government now is how can both the federal government and the provincial government, and sometimes the municipalities, how can they work together to solve a problem rather than back in 1867? Is it a federal or a provincial responsibility? Very often it's both now. And because of this situation, well, it used to be the case that if a particular problem arose, the federal government would say, well, it's not our responsibility, it's the provinces. Or the provinces would say, well, it's not us, it's the feds that can do this. It's getting harder for governments to do that because of this mixed jurisdiction. Pat Monahan has been through constitutional negotiations, the failed Charlottetown Accord, he knows how difficult it is, and very often his approach, what he's saying here is, you don't need to have a constitutional amendment for governments to be able to do what they want to do. You have to have interprovincial or federal-provincial negotiations, and they can, if the negotiations are successful, they can usually get their what they want to do. Then he talks about some of the rules of interpretation that we mentioned last week, some of them we mentioned last week, developed by the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council early on. The first is the watertight compartments. So Section 91 and 92 were compared to the watertight compartments on ships. Those watertight compartments are meant to prevent the ships from sinking. Didn't work with regard to the Titanic. But they're sealed off from each other so that if water gets into one of them, it's not supposed to get into the others, and it can be pumped out. So the JCPC compared sections 91 and 92 to watertight compartments, and their job was to figure out which compartment a particular subject matter fell into. So the definition of the subject matter is really important. And as we'll see, unless the legislation is very, very clear, it's possible for judges to define similar types of legislation with radically different subject matters, so they fit into different compartments. So there's the watertight compartments, there's the pith and substance. So very often a piece of legislation could deal with more than one subject matter. So early on, the JCPC said, well, what is the main subject matter? And they called that the pith and substance. So in some of the cases we look at today, you'll see that the judges say, well, yes, this particular piece of legislation does touch on both federal and provincial responsibilities, but the pith and substance is this, and that fits into either provincial or federal matter. So property and civil rights, which is a provincial matter, and therefore the provincial matters are generally more specific than the federal matters, even though it's a provincial specific matter, over time the JCPC interpreted property and civil rights extremely broadly. And the courts still do this because of those precedents. Then there's a doctrine called the aspect doctrine, sometimes called the double aspect doctrine, that a particular subject matter fits both into Section 91 and Section 92. In other words, the pith and substance is equally powerful for the provincial powers as for the federal powers. So therefore, that subject matter can be legislated on both by the federal government and the provinces. If the laws don't contradict each other, we have to obey both. If they do contradict each other, the federal law is paramount. Then there's the doctrine of exhaustiveness. That is, the old BNA Act, now called the Constitution Act 1867, covers all subject matters that governments can legislate in. There's nothing that is left out. It's exhaustive. Now, the preamble to Section 91, if you want to take a look at that, if you've got your book, it shall be lawful for the Queen by and with the advice and consent of the Senate and House of Commons to make laws for the peace, order, and good government of Canada in relation to all matters not coming within the classes of subjects by this Act assigned exclusively to the legislatures of the provinces and for greater certainty, but so as not to restrict the generality of the foregoing terms of this section, it is hereby declared that, notwithstanding anything in this Act, the exclusive legislative authority of the Parliament of Canada extends to all matters coming within the classes of subjects next hereinafter enumerated, that is to say. Now, isn't that a clear piece of prose? Wonderful writing. Inspiring. That's one of the key phrases in our Constitution that you've all memorized. It's a result of a political compromise. Both the centralists and the provincialists thought that they had won. And it turned out that with the interpretation of the JCPC, the provincialists won. But John A. Macdonald and the centralists thought that this meant that the preamble to Section 91 is a residual clause. That is, the provinces were given a few specific powers, not too many powers. Everything else would fall under POGG. And here's a list of examples of those POGG powers. But this is supposed to be a residual power. Well, from the very beginning, except for the Russell case, the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council was reluctant to use POGG as a residual clause. So very few subjects became federal jurisdiction because of the residual aspect of peace, order, and good government. So, any questions about Monaghan Chapter 7?
Just a question about pith and substance. Mm-hmm. Is pith and substance the same
It's a different concept. It simply means the central subject matter, the most important subject matter of a piece of legislation. So in every constitutional decision, both with regard to the division of powers and the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the first thing the judges have to do is to define the subject matter. And then there's a set of rules as to what the judges do once the subject matter is defined. So that's the one thing that you really have to look for in all constitutional cases. And then once the subject matter is defined, what's the pith and substance of that subject matter?
If you rule on that, the other matters that are kind of encompassed, joined together with the other one, they get a different, they get the same treatment as a central matter. No, they don't. They look separate.
No.
It's
a bit contradictory because they say, well, here's the subject matter, here's the pith and substance of the subject matter, that falls either under federal or provincial jurisdiction, they basically say, let's say the subject matter falls under federal jurisdiction, but it does have some provincial ramifications. That doesn't matter. As long as the pith and substance is federal, then the law is still valid, even though it incidentally or in a minor way affects the provinces. Now that seems to contradict watertight compartments. But there are all these theoretical concepts that the judges can use to try to decide. And in my career of interviewing judges, judges want to do what they think is the most just. They're passionate about doing justice. They're passionate about following the rule of law, and the law as it's written, but very often the law is not clear. So because these rules of interpretation are not clear, it gives them a certain amount of leeway to do justice. So the Parsons case. Yura is doing the presentation on that, is that right?
Yes.
Oh, great. So are you prepared to do that now?
No.
Yes. You don't have a PowerPoint or anything you have to put up, do you?
I have.
Oh, you do? Okay, great. Very first presentation. You get extra points for that. So, we're going to be going in the order of the sign-up sheet. So, I'll be doing some presentations, and you'll be doing some presentations. I'll be doing all of them at the end. Just one second. So thank you very much for doing this, Yura.
Thank you. Yes. Okay, good morning everyone. Today I'm going to introduce the case presentation which is called in Citizens Insurance Corporation versus Parsons. Also it's called in the Queen Insurance Corporation versus Parsons case. I try to determine what is the constitutional issue in this case. This issue is the validity of the Ontario Fire Insurance Policy Act, because this act prescribed uniform conditions for all fire insurance contracts, and unless variations from the statutory conditions were properly indicated. The next slide is going to show you who are the key players of these issues. The first, we have identified the persons who is the respondent in this case. He had taken in some actions against the two fire insurance companies to obtain compensation for damages by a fire in a warehouse insured by the companies. Also, the next key player is insurance company, because their defense was that persons shouldn't receive compensation because he had failed to observe the conditions that had been written in the companies that were prescribed by the Ontario statute. Also, the company's counsel argued that the Ontario statute was ultra vires. The next thing is issues. I tried to find some issues in this case. According to the case, it says the Judicial Committee declined to stretch trade and commerce in exclusive field of federal jurisdiction. Also, they prevent the provinces from regulating the contracts of a particular trade, such as the business of fire insurance in a province. Also, the committee refused to interpret in provincial jurisdiction or property and civil rights, so not only is to exclude rights arising from the contracts. Also, next thing is JCPs concluded that anything involved of property and civil rights in the province must be necessarily excluded from the federal power, which is regulation of trade and commerce. Because we already know that the section 91.2 is grants to the federal government an exclusive jurisdiction for trade and commerce. The next thing is, what is the validity of the Ontario Act? The Ontario Act in question had relation to matters coming within the class of subjects described in 92.13, which is in property and civil rights in the province. Especially this act deals with policies of insurance entered or enforced in the province of Ontario for insuring property located dating against fire, and also prescribes certain conditions which are to form a part of such contracts. Because these contracts are actually came legitimately within the class of subject property and civil rights in the province. Also, the Ontario Act relate to the subject of property and civil rights. Its enactments and provisions come within any of the classes, subjects which is enumerated in section 91. Also, the appellants suggested expressly including the subject of the Ontario Act, number 2, which is regulation of trade and commerce, because there's some judge's power of the validity of the Ontario Act. The next slide is is about the property and civil rights, because this was the first and major case to limit the trade and commerce power. And also there is the private counsel stated that there were actually two branches or categories to the federal power or trade and commerce in section 91 of the Constitutional Act. The first branch is the regulation of interprovincial and international trade. And the JCPC interpreted the regulation of trade and commerce in very broad way, we already read in from the case. And also, they have largely ignored the possibility that federal regulation directed at local trade might nevertheless be